Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome back. I'm Dr. Deborah.
Hi, it's Coach Kelly here.
Yay, Coach Kelly's back.
I missed you.
I missed you too. But you were not gone for happy reasons this time.
No.
And that is actually what inspired today's show. But
yes.
I just want to touch base a little bit because you did miss a fabulous show last week when we had the lead actor writer from the movie Waking and also the director. And so we had a really fun interview about fantasy girl versus real girl, dream girl versus real girl.
It was a great show.
Oh, you did listen.
I don't know. Maybe I should leave more often. I thought it was amazing.
No, never.
No, it was great. You did a great job. And, you know, they both were very engaging. It was wonderful.
Yeah. So I encourage you, if you did miss the show live last week, please download it. It's a great show. So as you know, it is you, the listener, who makes our show. So we are very eager to talk to you today and hope that you'll give us a call at 323-203-0815. Again, 323-203-0815. And you can always email us. So before I introduce our guest, who is a long-term friend of mine, I'm so happy to have him here. Kelly, tell us what inspired the show, because
sure.
You did have to go for another loss.
Exactly. Okay, so about 2 months ago, my best friend's father passed away from brain cancer. I'm from the East Coast, so I flew back to the East Coast to be with her. He had a life expectancy about 15 to 18 months, so, you know, we sort of had a possibility that this could happen. So I went back. But surprisingly, her brother just passed away. He was 35, and he had a rare vascular connective tissue disease. And what happened with him, it was kind of discovered a few months ago that this could be a potential. It wasn't, fatal, but he needed surgery on an artery, and he went in to get surgery. That actually was successful, but later on, about, 4 or 6 hours later, he had a stroke, and that's what, made him pass. So it was absolutely devastating for them to have these two major losses in 2 months. And for me as well,
absolutely.
I grew up with him, and he was just a wonderful guy and, young. It's just... It was absolutely devastating.
The picture of you with him at your bat mitzvah.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, so sweet.
Yeah.
So I'm so sorry for your loss. But that was the inspiration for today's show. We have a show about grief and loss, and we have the guy here to talk to us about that. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Russell Friedman, who is the founder of the Grief Recovery Institute, and he is the front runner in the Grief Recovery Method. And just as a starting point, you can always look him up at griefrecoverymethod.com. Mm-hmm. Russell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. My honor and privilege to be here with the two of you. And I would reach over and hug you, and maybe after the show I'll offer
you
a hug.
Thank you so much. I'll take it.
It's awesome. Yeah, I met Russell, I think it was 13 years ago. He was kind enough and gracious enough to meet with me, and then he endorsed my first book, Healing the Sensitive Heart. And so we've stayed in touch, but it's been quite a while.
It really has. And you somehow look younger than you did. I do not.
No.
You probably didn't even recognize the guy with no hair that used to be red hair, right?
Red hair.
By the way, just because people are listening, I am not the founder. I'm co-founder. John W. James is the founder of the Grief Recovery Institute.
Okay.
So just for clarity's sake, because, truth is I learned it all from him. I may have added something to our lore, but he was the person who, in reaction to the death of his 3-day-old baby son 37 years ago, developed this method that we teach in order to save his own life, because he was going out. He could not figure out a way to keep on living in the aftermath of that death. And he actually was standing at the beach with a gun at his head to kill himself, the gun he'd used in Vietnam. And he chickened out, and he said, I have to find a better way. I'm not going to spend another 50 years on this planet feeling to." And what he did to discover how to help himself wound up being applicable not only to death, mm-hmm. not only death of a baby, but to divorce and all 40 other losses you can have. So now it's kind of this universal system that helps each of us individually or uniquely if we use it. It works. It works for anybody who is willing, no exceptions.
Okay.
Well, I'll say that, you know, I think it's hard for some people to understand even the whole breadth of loss, right? So often people think of loss as simply a death.
Yes.
Not simply a death, like that is huge. But I mean, as you're saying, there are so many ways.
43. There are 43 life events that can produce feelings of grief. Obviously, death is one of them. Uh-huh. Divorce is another. Uh-huh. Moving is a major grief event.
Yes.
And here's how we explain it. Grief is defined as the conflicting feelings caused by a change or end in a familiar pattern of behavior. If someone's been alive your whole mm-hmm. life or as long as you've known them and then they die, that's the end of that familiarity. You've been living with someone as your spouse and that ends, that's the end of that. Moving, even if you move to a better house in a nicer neighborhood, everything familiar changes. Yeah. Do you know how, and here's a big one, this was surprising. I went bankrupt 28 years ago, and you can guess or imagine that that's a powerful loss,
okay?
Absolutely. Do either of you realize that the vast majority of people who win major lotteries all over the world lose all the money within 3 years and wind up in therapy they didn't really need before? They also wind up with more relatives than they ever knew they had.
Of course.
But winning the lottery is a grief event. Because everything familiar changes the way you see yourself, the world sees you. Now, 90% of the people lose all the money in 3 years. Can you guess the 10% of people who don't lose the money? Do you know who they are?
No.
The ones who were wealthy to begin with, not even super wealthy. Because if you've got a lot of money, getting more money, okay, you know how to behave.
Sure. Yes.
If you're middle class or less or whatever, and all of a sudden you're wealthy, who are you?
Right.
Where's your identity? So grief is about change. Change is the key word. Okay. And and example, a divorce is a death of a relationship, isn't it? It's the death of hopes, dreams, and expectations. So this applies to everything. It even applies to people in your life. If your son or daughter is struggling with alcohol or drugs, is that a loss for you?
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a loss of your hopes, dreams, and expectations of what their life would be and your life with them. So almost anything that involves change is grief by definition.
God, that's so interesting.
Interesting, too. This is a little sideways, but I was doing a continuing education course on the recent trends in understanding infidelity. Uh-huh. And it was very poignant that they said that even the spouse who is discovered as having an affair and having to end that affair requires time in their therapeutic process for them to grieve that. Imagine telling that to the husband or the wife. Like, but wait a minute, we can't deal with you yet. This one has to grieve the loss of the one they were screwing on the side.
Wow.
Right? But it's true, right?
Yep.
As you're saying.
Absolutely.
Sure.
All change is grief, period. No exceptions.
That's amazing.
Yes. And even if it's a positive change, it still comes along with...
You know, a lot of people get elevated in their job or career and then can't stay in that because it's a change. If you kind of get kicked upstairs from a regular worker to an executive, very hard adaptation. It's a huge issue in business, adapting to the change successfully. And it's not easy. I mean, I've written about it, and it's an ongoing problem. And it's not different than winning the lottery, if you think about it.
Right.
Who am I now?
Yeah.
And remember, your former coworkers who you were pals with now perceive you differently. You've been elevated, and now things change. And that's really uncomfortable for an awful lot of people.
Wow. This is incredible.
Excuse me, Kelly, it would be great for our listeners if you could share some of the many feelings that you went through over the last couple of weeks, as well as what you observed in your best friend and your best friend's mother. I mean,
exactly. Sure. So, yeah, just grouping it all together. I mean, of course, I think the number one was, well, first of it was like shock. I could see it in my friends' faces. I mean, it was almost like there were points that she was so normal, it scared me. Like, I felt like, you know, she's like, let's go to Starbucks, we'll get a latte. You know, and I was like, like, I couldn't, you know, she clearly, it was almost like it didn't penetrate.
Would that be maybe a holding on to not wanting to acknowledge that a change has occurred?
Like a denial?
No, it's not denial. It's more in the range of what you said. It's more in the shock range, although not a technical shock. What it is the degree of difficulty, if I go there and allow it, even though it is true, I can't take it. People think they'll start crying and won't ever be able to stop. They think they'll have feelings that will kill them. So they try to wall themselves away from it, which makes sense.
Sure.
It's, and most of us were taught that we weren't supposed to feel bad in the first place. You're supposed to be strong. You're supposed to be over it in a few days. And so she, this woman, was hit with that. It also reminds me what sometimes happens with little children. It's different. You have a little child who doesn't fully understand the concept of death or the permanence of death. And after they find out that mommy or daddy or grandma or grandpa has died, they go, oh, that's sad. They know it's sad.
Yeah.
But they don't really know what it means. So then they'll go out and play as if nothing happened. And when you, I wrote equal to child. When you said that, I went, it sounds similar. Now, it is different. And really, she's trying to protect herself. Is it protective? In a minor way, yes. Because it isn't safe for her yet to feel about it.
Wow.
So she's protecting herself. And literally, when a spouse dies or when a child dies, especially with a spouse, a long-term spouse, the chances are your health and life can be dramatically affected.
Yes.
More spouses die after the death of their spouse than after any other loss.
Yeah.
Because the change is so huge.
Oh.
It's beyond belief. I'm sure you both heard stories where a husband dies and 6 months later the wife dies or vice versa with no medical reason.
Exactly.
Right. Is it a broken heart? Yes.
Yeah.
Is it also may have some mechanics of health? Yes.
Sure.
But it's usually the pressures of the emotional thing. Even if the person is relatively healthy, psychologically, whatever, it's just a huge burden. And it only happens primarily with long-term spouses.
Oh, okay.
The relation there is different than any other relation. You can have a much longer relationship with your parent, but it isn't have that level.
Sure.
You leave home at 20 or 21. You may be 50 or 60 when your parent dies, but you haven't lived with them for 50. You live with a spouse for 40 years, day in and day out.
Yeah.
It is literally like losing a piece of your body.
Yes. Absolutely.
And to some degree, that may have affected this woman in
the
dual, and the dual loss. By the way, I have a note on that.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that.
Let me go to this, and then it may help or you may want to add to it. If you do not have the skills to deal with the first loss, then you don't have the skills to deal with the second loss. It isn't the multiple losses. It's the absence of knowing what to do with it. In a grief recovery sense, what do I do to discover and complete what's emotionally unfinished for me between me and my husband? I can do that. Even then, if my son dies, I will know I know how to do that. Now, I'm not trying to make it sound easy or simple.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. But if you don't know what to do, you're trapped.
Right.
Then the second one overloads. It's like you're drowning. You just start to take a gulp of air. Another wave comes and drowns you. You have three or four of them, and you're lost, but you still don't have skills for dealing with it.
Yeah, and most people don't even understand that there is a toolbox.
Well, I was just going to say, and can you tell us some of those skills? I mean, I don't know if it's so simple as you'd be able to, but... You know, at least to pass it on for her.
Yes. And interestingly, we really can't start very well at the solution. You got to go to a pre-problem.
Okay.
And let me do this as quickly as I can. In all of our books, The Grief Recovery Handbook, When Children Grieve, and the others, we highlight six major myths that affect all grieving people in our society and in most cultures around the world. I just got back from Singapore. I did a training there. Last year, I did one. In Australia, everywhere in the world, these myths, even whether they're in English or not, they prevail.
Oh, pick me. I remember one.
Would it be a traveling companion?
Yeah, exactly. I remember one very strongly when I read your first book, The Grief Recovery Handbook, which was Time Heals All Wounds.
Right.
I was just going to say
that is a crock. Time heals nothing unless you're healing within that time.
Unless you're doing something to cause something to heal.
And that's
one of them. It's one of the six. But let's take that one for a minute because we can even, in spite of the nature of the topic, we can have a little fun with that.
Okay.
Imagine, close your eyes, both of you. Imagine you go out down to your car after the show, okay? And as you approach your car, you see it doesn't look right and you see you have a flat tire. So here's a question. Keep your eyes closed. Would you pull up a chair and sit down and wait for air to jump back in your tire?
Right.
Unlikely. Because we come back 100 years later, there would be your skeleton with its clothes on, and the tire would still be flat.
Mm-hmm.
time can't fix a broken heart any more than time can fix a flat tire. And it requires action to fix the tire. You got to call the auto club or you got to change, take the jack out and change it. Well, a broken heart is remarkably like a flat tire, isn't it? Mm-hmm. The get up and go is got up and went. The ability to participate fully in life is limited. Your energy level is really low. And time doesn't fix it. In fact, here's the scary, sad news. I have talked to in the neighborhood of 100,000 grieving people, and I don't mean here on the radio or on TV where it's millions, and individual conversations over 28 years, because I talked to 20, 30, 40 people a day for all these years, and the vast majority of people who called our, what we used to have a grief recovery helpline, an 800 number, and I'd spend 8 hours a day helping people on the phone. Vast majority of them were elderly widows or widowers, probably 60 to 65% of them, whose spouse of 30, 40, 50, 60 years had died. And in the course of a conversation, at some point I would say, well, I guess you realize by now that they lied to us, that time doesn't heal your broken heart.
Of course.
And without any other language from me, 99% of them would say, yeah, and it seems like it's getting worse.
Oh, really?
Now, understand this, Kelly. Yeah. At that point, they've called a stranger, me, on an 800 number, and it's usually a year or two after the death of their spouse.
Okay.
And their lives have so deteriorated that they're reaching out on an 800 number because they're desperate.
Yes.
Their family, everybody, the world has moved on. Their friendships have diminished.
Right.
Their families don't understand. Their kids and grandkids are busy in their own community doing their thing.
Yes.
Nobody knows how to listen to them, and nobody knows how to help them. And they are stuck with the same myth that all of us got, that time heals all wounds. And it can't, and never could, and never will. Recovery, completion, healing, whatever word you want to do, happens within time as a result of actions taken.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Time can't do anything except go by.
Yes.
Dr. Deborah, if I hurt your feelings, will time pick up the phone and call you and apologize?
Absolutely not.
I have to call or go to your house or say, I am sorry. And until I do that, I am unfinished, and you may or may not be also. Your part is different. You have something different you have to do. We might talk about it later, okay? But let's go back to the myths.
Yeah.
The first myth we all get, no matter what, is don't feel bad. As in, don't feel bad here, honey. Have a cookie. You'll feel better.
Yeah.
So here's the question. Does a cookie make a little kid feel better, or does it make a kid feel different? Pick one.
Different.
Yeah. You put some sugar in my body, or it's going to change you a little.
Yeah.
It's going to distract you a little. Mm-hmm. But have we addressed what the other little girls or boys did to you on the playground?
Right.
No. Excuse me. So we all start.
Eating disorders and drug addiction, actually.
Hello.
Yeah.
You take a four-year-old boy or girl, and by the way, gender is totally irrelevant in these myths. Everybody is taught the same thing. Take a little girl, let's say it's a girl, it's preschool, and her mommy and daddy teach her to medicate her feelings with substance by saying, don't feel bad, here, have a cookie, you'll feel better.
Right.
The kid doesn't have the capacity to say, mom, what? Well, I want to talk about what happened.
Yeah.
Sure. They just
the kid's
going to
gobble the ice cream and be confused. 10 years later, take that same little girl, she's 14, has had her first romantic breakup, and she's moping across the playground, and someone goes, hey, here, try this, you'll feel better. And they give her a joint or a beer, okay?
Yep.
Or, as you know, we have a pandemic of childhood obesity, not to mention adult obesity.
Yeah.
Blessedly, in this room, I see none of that. He said, make a left-handed compliment with both hands. And so we start off with an illogical idea. Now, I am personally right now and excitedly involved with the socialization of my one and only brand new granddaughter, who will be 17 months old next week.
Congrats.
Thank you. My stepdaughter adopted this little girl, and we are all just
in love.
Head over heels, beyond in love. In love would be so minimal compared to how I feel. And we are watching the progression of what can happen to children. And, of course, this child is never told, don't feel bad. When she cries, oh, you sad? Okay, you're crying? Okay. She has never told it's not okay.
Right.
Because with what I teach, if you told my little granddaughter not to feel bad, I would have to harm you or get you out of the room real fast. Humor aside, By the time she gets to school, hopefully she'll be so grounded in truthful communication mm-hmm. that they won't be able to push her off it. But the world's still going to be telling, don't feel bad, tomorrow's another mm-hmm. day, don't, and you'll get over it and all that nonsense.
Yes.
So don't feel bad is the chronicling piece of misinformation that sets us all up in conflict with our nature. It is our nature to be honest about how we feel. If you're happy, you say you're happy. If you're mm-hmm. sad, you say you're sad. Except if it gets taken away by adult authority figures yeah. like parents and teachers and so on, don't right. feel bad, hair of a cookie. It puts you in conflict with your truth.
Sure. Right.
And I get to see people because of what I do who were literally, in a way, and not only literally, figuratively and literally brutalized to never show that they feel sad because they would get in trouble.
It's
you're
going to
cry, go to your room.
Tragic. Yes.
Yeah. And this is just one of the six myths. Right. The next
Hang
one.
Hang on, before we go there,
okay.
if you just tuned in, you are listening to Dr. Deborah and
Coach Kelly
and our very special guest, Russell Friedman from the Grief Recovery Method. And we'd love to have your phone calls. So please call us at 323-203-0815. Russell has kindly brought four of his five books, and he will autograph them if we get a caller.
Yes.
You can have a free copy of one of his magnificent books, and I can tell you that they are magnificent.
Yes.
So he is right now telling us about the myths of grieving.
Yeah.
So we've got number one, which is
don't feel bad.
Number two.
It puts you behind a negative eight ball starting out in life.
Yeah.
You know, at your earliest thing, and you got to understand, it comes from high authorities. Mom and dad are high authority sources, as well they should be. And this is not an attack on moms and dads or religion or culture or families. It's what it is. It's a multi-generational pass-through of misinformation. It just runs downhill.
Yeah.
Nobody's, you know, most people don't say, what am I saying? Is this accurate? Is this truthful? Does time really heal? Does it make sense to tell someone who feels bad not to feel bad?
Right.
For example, Kelly or Dr. Deborah, if you call me up one day and say, hey, and I say, how you doing? You say, it's going great. The radio show's great. My personal life, everything's going great. Would I go, don't feel good? I mean, doesn't that sound stupid?
Not, right? Yeah.
But if you call and say your favorite aunt died, someone says, oh, don't feel bad. She's in a better place. Well, maybe she is. You're not.
Exactly.
Hello? So all this moving stuff from people's hearts to their heads, trying to get them not to feel, you are not doing them any favor.
Sure, right.
And we'll get to that in a minute when we come to the third myth. The second myth is replace the loss. And we highlight it in all our books using the story of John James when he's a little boy and the safest entity in the universe for him was his dog, Peggy. He lived in a violent alcoholic household, just war all the time. Mm-hmm. And the dog was the only place that he could go, the only place where he could talk honestly and feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And when the dog died, his mother, who loved him, said, don't feel bad, honey. Okay, Saturday we'll get you a new dog.
Mm-hmm.
And the next week they did go get John a new dog. And if you ever meet John, ask him the name of that dog. He can't tell you. He could not develop a connection to that dog because, A, he was seven. What did he want?
That.
He wanted Peggy back.
Yeah.
You know, he
yeah.
knew he could. He knew, but he didn't know.
Right.
And he wasn't going to risk getting his heart broken again by attaching to another dog.
And he's been taught, don't feel bad.
Absolutely.
Feel bad, so and sad. Here's another.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
right.
so... Like, and we use John's story, but like however many years later, six, 7 years later, he's a senior in high school and his first ever girlfriend breaks up with him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Threw him over for a drummer. John never has liked rock and roll since then. Anyhow, when that girl threw him over, John was moping around the house for about 3-4 days. His mother says, honey, don't feel bad. There are plenty of fish in the sea,
sure.
which is the first time he knew he'd been dating a fish.
He
thought it was this nice girl named
fish.
Wanda.
Anyhow,
humor aside again, a powerful learning set of experiences, just those two, and there were many others in between, where your own parent, authority figure, is telling you not to feel bad and to replace the loss. But relationships are not replaceable. Each of us, if you and I are in love and we break up, my heart's been broken. Even if I've had enough of you, you've had enough of me, feeling bad about that is one thing. But I have to have an opportunity to grieve and complete what didn't finish, all the broken hopes, dreams, and expectations, that happy sunset we were supposed to go to.
Yeah.
But if I'm told, don't feel bad, go date someone else.
Exactly.
It takes away the natural need and process need to deal with what happened and didn't happen. Otherwise, you go to your next relationship, you just bounce, start and date someone, and you have this collection of unfinished business, emotional mm-hmm. baggage, if you will, mm-hmm. okay? And you bring that, and it causes you to hold back.
Sure.
Now, women and men are co-equal. You cannot blame men anymore. Yeah. Women are the same. Right. Both hold back. If you and I start dating, but you're still unfinished with your prior, and I'm finished, prior sounds like a crime. Right. And some relationships are criminal. And then you're going to hold back, and I'm going to hold back. And what we do is guarantee that we sabotage our future.
Right, which is
absolute guarantee.
We're putting up a relationship. Wall. Yeah. I mean, it just, they don't work.
They can't.
Yeah.
They can't. So now we have don't feel bad and replace the loss. Two criminally incorrect things because mm-hmm. the assumption of replacing a relationship makes no sense. Even with a dog, yes. Dogs yeah. are unique and we're unique and they are never the same, even in the same breed. They each have their yes. own yep. persona. In any litter, they're all different.
Yep.
Okay? Mm-hmm. And to assign them the equality with the dog, and to want them to be like the dog before. If I want you to be like my ex-wife, what do I want to be with you for?
Exactly.
You know? And the dog has to be allowed to have its own persona, which yeah. is where the joy comes from in right. that matchup. Now, I hate to say which of the myths is the worst, because certainly the time heals one is the most pernicious.
Yeah.
But they're all pernicious. They're yeah. all bad. And the big one is, I'm going to say a sentence, and I'd like to ask the two of you and any free one listening mm-hmm. to put in the word that I leave out at the end of the sentence. Okay. And you'll know it, okay? Laugh and the whole world laughs with you. Cry and you cry
alone.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, we were all brainwashed to believe that. Is it true? No.
Right.
It's a lie. It's a myth. It's illogical. I live with a 17-month-old child. She does not grieve alone. She, right. at the top of her lungs, says, hey, you get over here. I'm hungry. I'm tired. Mm-hmm. I need change. Let's go. I want to go for a walk. Wow, she doesn't do anything alone that way. She doesn't isolate her feelings. She has never been stopped mm-hmm. from feeling. Mm-hmm. Okay? And hopefully by the time she's older and she won't be a yeah. squalling infant, she'll know how to properly express her feelings and whatever. Yep. You know, at her age, she doesn't have much volume control. That will go later.
Yeah, yeah. Either to my kids and they're older.
Yeah. So grieve alone is okay. the other most pernicious. They're all pernicious. The wow. other worst mm-hmm. one. And if I were to say to you, and I know your heads will nod, if I say grieving people tend to isolate, you'll both go, yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Why do they isolate? They're taught.
Yes, that they can't do it in front of.
Right.
Wow, this
if you're going
to
cry, go to your room.
You don't understand. You'll yes. never understand.
Well, and there's just that shame and embarrassment. I should pull it together.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
You shouldn't be real or human. Don't please don't confuse me with the truth here.
Exactly.
And we're going to be in a relationship. How am I going to trust you if you're not honest?
Wow, this is
it doesn't even
incredible.
Work.
I will say, though, in Judaism, there is mm-hmm. some understanding of all this because the time frame, at least, that people honor.
Sitting Shiva and what has a virtue, it has some flaws, too. It's not as perfect as I would like to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some elements missing. There isn't any recovery element, which I would love to be. But, you know, mm-hmm. Judaism, I'm Jewish, too, isn't yeah. going to ask me to rewrite the books, you know, for them. So I just have to leave it.
Right.
But the grief alone is colossally bad. I'll give you an idea scientifically how bad. A study came out in 1984 that indicated that a child in our society, by the time he or she is 15 years old, mm-hmm. they've had more than 23,000 inputs suggesting A, that they not feel bad, and B, that they not tell anyone about it.
Oh, go to your room, 23,000.
23,000 by age 15.
Holy
I personally think it could be higher because it's everywhere. It's in all the literature, movies, wow. television, books. Everyone says, oh, don't feel bad.
Right.
Don't feel bad tomorrow.
Exactly.
Everything is couched in don't feel bad.
Yeah.
And we're going, why not? And how could you possibly
not feel
perceive
bad.
Joy if you can't perceive sadness?
Mm-hmm.
How could you even know how you
yeah,
feel? We need this duality, if you will.
So I want to just back up for 1 second because I'm sure our listeners want to know too. So if somebody is grieving and you're sort of, you know, your reaction is to say, oh, don't feel bad, or you want to cheer him up, or I'm thinking about my son when he falls and he's hysterical and I'm uncomfortable and I want him to stop and he's screaming. So are you saying you just either, you know, basically not say anything and let them feel? Or is there something that, you know, you recommend to say so that they can, you know, feel like it's safe? Or
great question. And because I'm involved with the little 17-month-old, and what
yeah.
I had to teach, what I learned before, and I had to teach my spouse and her daughter, mm-hmm. the baby's mom, is to avoid the gasp reflex.
Yes.
Every
yes.
time the baby, and then the baby learns because they get a reward. You give, and so
yes.
this baby has been socialized, so we let her fall and then see what she does with it.
Uh-huh.
If she cries and whatever. But and most times she doesn't cry, she just gets up and goes. She's like a little Tonka truck.
Yeah.
She's okay. She checks, does her own inventory, and if she's okay, she moves. If not, she goes, okay. But from the point of view with your, I think your son's probably a little older and all, what the thing that really parallels, and I love the question, Kelly, is that you can say, oh, gosh, I imagine that really hurts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's different than saying don't feel bad.
Right.
It says if he's crying, oh, I imagine that really hurt. Is, I imagine that's a little bit painful. Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, doesn't it hurt when you scrape yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Why would you deny him that? And the way to honor it without over enabling her and doing anything wrong with it or trying to cause him to always be trying to get a wrong kind of attention.
Right.
It's just say, wow, you imagine that's a little painful? And he'll go, yeah, or not so bad.
Right.
It'll allow him to find the truth rather than you painting something on it that could distort it.
That
where he's
going to
go get
sense.
A false kind of attention.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, look, let's be fair. They're delightfully manipulative. You watch them going for everything they can get, which is they're pushing every envelope there is. And I love the ones who do that.
Children are manipulative,
Oh my God, am I going to be quoted on the air? They're probably the child services is going to come and take me away for thinking that. No, they are, and they should be. I mean,
it's survival,
and more. We watch in our we have a nice ethic with our little family of three and the baby. My spouse and her daughter and me are we're almost like co-parents in it, is we are thrilled when she's willful. I mean, you have to tolerate it, but we want a persona. We want somebody. We want a little girl who will be a woman who knows who she is and can communicate. We don't want any of her hidden under a bushel, you know.
Yes.
Again, it's sometimes pain, but we've also learned effectively how to distract her from the tantrums.
Yeah.
And she's blessedly is distractible. So instead of having to go and have a fist, you know, an argument with her about it, because you can't be reasonable with kids, but you can distract. She's, you know, delightfully distracted. Distractible.
Yes.
You got to redirect her.
Sure.
You can't do that with all kids.
Yeah, exactly.
But she's very smart, and yet she allows us to shift her.
Yeah.
You know, and she can have her own little obsessions and stuff. Anyhow, this wasn't supposed to be a show about that, but.
However, if you did just tune in, you are listening to Dr. Deborah and
Coach Kelly.
And we are here with the charming, delightful, and highly intelligent Russell Friedman from the Grief Recovery Institute /Method. And please, at any time, visit his website at griefrecoverymethod.com, and we'll go more into his books and such later on. But please give us a call too at 323-203-0815, 323-203-0815. He does have a stack of books here he's willing to sign, and anybody who calls in can get a free book. This is so informative. So
this is amazing.
Yeah, I think it would be really great if we can make sure we get through the six.
Yes, exactly.
So we've gotten through three.
She's like, hurry
up. Is she saying, Kelly, that I talk too much?
No. I think there might be a hidden
talk just enough, but I want to make sure we don't run out of time.
Okay,
so
we're on the fourth myth.
We're on the fourth myth. And just so you know, I just yesterday finished delivering a 4-day grief recovery certification training.
So you're on fire.
I'm on fire. It's like I think when I was talking in my sleep last night, I was saying, honey, the seminar's over, but I still have more to say. Anyhow, the grieving alone, the isolation that happens to grievers is so... pandemic in our society. It is so everywhere. And here's another way. For example, you may have been told when you had feelings as a little girl, or for those of us who are guys, don't burden others with your feelings.
Yes.
What an obscene comment.
Sure.
Because what it would mean, Kelly, is that your joy could be a burden to me also.
That's true.
If I'm in just a so-so mood and you're all chipper this way? Hi, I don't know. I go, oh, gosh, get her out of here with that upness, you know? So it isn't a question of your feelings being a burden. The only way you could ever burden me, either of you, is by lying to me. And one of the famous lies for grieving people, and we have a whole chapter in the Grief Recovery Handbook that's entitled I'm Fine and Other Lies. When someone, you say, how are you? Someone says, I'm fine. And you go, oh God, I don't believe that for a minute.
Well, you know, in the hospital settings, what that actually stands for?
Yes, I do.
Effed up, insecure, neurotic, and
envious. Or
in
whatever variation.
Yeah, well, you're fine to me. Well, then why are you here?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, if you're all that, go home.
Well, it's the other one about be nice. Be nice is pretend not to know. That's another version of being fine.
So, but if you were socialized that you shouldn't feel bad in the first place, then the whole thing of not burdening others makes sense.
Yep. Yeah.
but it never makes sense in the first. You have kids, you know. Yeah. They are emotional beings. We all are, by definition. No, we're different. Some are more external, some are a little shyer, but we're still, emotion is what drives us, you know, as well it should. It's not a bad thing.
So is that number four, burdening other, that I'm burdening?
No, grieving alone, I kind of put that in there because it's the reason you grieve alone is because your feelings would be a burden on someone else. Okay, it's just part, there are many cliches around the myths. You could spend all day and kind of come up with a whole bunch of other little languages that go, God, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And what I want people to hear today is, and this was really in aid of talking about your friend's mother.
Yeah.
I can't help her, or she can't get help until she first dismisses all these myths.
Yes.
Because I guarantee she was socialized to not feel bad, not burden others, and be strong, and all this other stuff, which we're getting to. And if you don't take those myths out of the way, you can't do the work.
Yes.
Okay? If you still believe you shouldn't feel bad, then how can I help you?
This makes so much
sense.
Place,
okay?
This is incredible.
Now, so the fourth myth, although there's not a real order, the fourth one we happen to, this just takes time, which we have spent some time on with the car, you know, and the
flat time heals
tire.
All.
Right. Time,
yeah.
Time heals all wounds, which, by the way, the initials that are THAW, just for whatever it means, doesn't mean anything, but time heals all wounds.
I like it.
Or grief just takes time. That's another very common, the two most common ways.
Yeah.
And time goes by. Nothing, it can't do anything. It doesn't have the capacity for action. Is what you do within time that causes things to happen.
Right.
Sure.
Look, one of my favorite ways of saying that is like, sit down in front of the piano every day and never lift the cover, never touch the keys. He's doing an hour a day for 20 years.
How
can you play the piano?
How did you know that I've been doing that? My baby grand comes with me everywhere, and you know what?
You never play it.
No, I used to be able to play. It intimidates me. It says, you used to play me. Why aren't you playing me now? But I can't tell you.
Alice does the same thing. We have a baby grand in our living room. Now that we have the baby, I'll play for her.
Okay,
that's good.
Twinkle, twinkle.
Have you been spying
all those years of
house?
Lessons. We could double up on Twinkle.
That's very funny.
So, the time can't heal. Only actions taken within time can heal.
Okay.
The fifth myth, and I know both of you and everyone listening can relate. Were either of you socialized to be strong or be strong for others?
Of course.
Makes no sense.
Yeah.
Okay? How can you be anything for me, Kelly? You can love me and be supportive, but you can't do for me. If I have a headache and you take an aspirin, who gets better?
Yeah.
If I lift weights, who's going to get the muscles?
Exactly.
And so now, here's the real trap with being strong. And this is it has destroyed many marriages, especially those that had a child die.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a child die, both parents are devastated.
Of course.
Yeah.
The mother may be crying, and the husband will kick in. And this is the one place, or one of the few places, where gender has a play in the myth thing. The husband will kick in to be strong for my wife, and in aid of doing that, he will cover up or hide his feelings.
Right.
To which the wife goes, oh, he didn't love our baby, which isn't true, but that's what it looks like.
Yeah.
Because being strong means not showing how you feel.
Right.
I always tell parents of young children, don't hide your feelings.
Yeah.
Because they will copy the hiding.
Exactly.
Okay, sure. Your little son or daughter's going to go, well, mommy doesn't cry, mommy doesn't tell the truth, so I don't.
Right.
And the first chapter of our book, Monkey See, When Children Grieve, is Monkey See, Monkey Do. And there's a powerful, heart-wrenching story in there of how a little boy copied his mother after the father died.
Aww.
And she was busy being strong and not saying things, so he wouldn't talk to her.
Oh,
tragic.
And
that's
a normal badness, because he's copying the only tour guide leader he has left. Dad's gone. Mom's the leader.
Oh,
okay.
Gosh.
So being strong makes no sense, because what you're doing is sending a false signal. You're sending a lie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Which is always going to be incorrectly interpreted. They're not going, oh, well, he's doing that. He's not showing he feels an aid of helping me. But the reality is that how helpful would it be if you and I are a couple, we're trying to talk about something that has meaning, but I'm not showing how I feel.
Yeah.
Okay. And by the way, women and men both do it. Now, in that particular setting, men might be more liable to do it than women, but not always. There are times when men come in who are just devastated, and their wife is being strong for him.
Right, exactly.
Even with a child death.
Uh-huh. And it reinforces the sense that feelings are dangerous, and that having feelings means that you're weak. So it's a terrific negative feedback loop. There's no way to win that one.
And it loops right onto don't feel bad.
Yeah, exactly.
It also loops onto grieve alone.
Yep.
you know?
Okay, so we got be strong is number five.
And be strong for others, which makes no sense at all.
Exactly.
Okay.
Totally.
And the last of the six myths is a simple one, and I'm sure you both heard it growing up. You got to keep busy. When something sad happens,
yes.
You got to keep busy.
Yes.
And that's as pernicious as all the others. It's my favorite word, pernicious,
exactly.
The word du jour. Keeping busy merely creates a distraction. Mm-hmm. And I personally think, even though we developed these six myths, that it's a satellite of one of the other five.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's a satellite. Do you know which one? Can you guess?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. This is a test.
Yeah, I'm
Coach,
like,
Coach
I
Kelly
didn't,
is
I
being
didn't
tested
study.
On live air. You can't fail, but you can. Any guess you get is good, but the one's better than the others.
Okay, so
I'm going to say replace the loss.
Good try.
I failed.
No Disneyland trip for you.
I'm going to say time heals.
Yes.
Kelly wins a book.
Yes. Yes. And now for the free trip to Disneyland, which of course you'll have to pay for. Why did you say that?
Well, they go together because they both have to do with time. It's like
You're almost right. What it is that the illusion is that if I can just make time go by keeping busy, then time will go by and I'll feel better. So you really did have it right.
Yeah.
That's what happens.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's an illusion.
Well, there's no soothing. Soothing is what actually heals, not distraction. Distraction is something we need to do on occasion, right?
Actually, soothing doesn't heal, not to contradict you. Actions to complete create what you might call healing. I avoid the word healing as much as possible because it's too big a promise to make. But we talk about helping people discover and complete what was left emotionally unfinished for them by a death, a divorce, or another loss. Soothing is wonderful, but has really nothing to do with recovery. Soothing is being nice. As long as you can hug someone, you can listen to them. But if you just listen to someone talk about grief, you may be doing them a disservice. Because when you talk about grief, what you get good at is talking about grief. And what word is missing from that? Recovery.
Yeah.
Recovery is missing. And again, I didn't mean to contest you, but soothing is a short-term thing just in interaction, but it doesn't, and we don't even recommend that idea in what we do, even in interaction. You don't need to soothe your son.
Right.
You need to see, hear what he's saying.
Exactly.
And I think if I would have to say, most people don't feel heard. That's what happens to children. No one hears what they're saying.
So I include empathy as part of soothing. That's what I'm hearing you
say.
Being able to be empathetic is a soothing mechanism. But that's okay. I'll go.
That's right. Yeah, and again, I apologize for.
No, it's fine. I want to learn.
And I want to understand a little bit more. So you're saying discover and complete what was lost.
What was left emotionally unfinished.
Okay.
And so let me language that for you, and this will relate to your friend's mom greatly.
Yeah, exactly.
At any point in a relationship, certainly after someone dies or after we get divorced or at any point with someone either you love or you're estranged from, it doesn't matter. There are always things we wish had happened differently, better, or more.
Mm-hmm.
And there are always unrealized hopes, dreams, and expectations about the future. Those six words, different, better, more, hopes, dreams, and expectations, is the only words I need to help get a griever moving towards recovery.
Wow.
Because we're searching in those categories. Mm-hmm. Anything that doesn't fit in those categories is not relevant to what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Some is just storyline, and people just, oh, mom, I've seen people write 200-page letters after mom died. I really miss you, and I was in the shoe store, and I thought about it, I miss you, and I feel sad. You know, that's not recovery. It's kind of a lament. It's a newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
It may have some short-term cathartic benefit, but no long-term completion.
Because
it's really not about the relationship other than feeling sad and missing her, which is really about grief, not recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And the real distinction is between grief and recovery. I am not in the grief business. I'm in the grief recovery business. I hate to use the word business there. But helping people make these discoveries. Now, both of you know people who can recite a PhD of discovery of what they know, what happened with them and mom or dad or husband or wife, but they don't know how to complete it. So they loop it. They're like a hamster on a wheel going round and round and round. Our job is to help them get off that wheel effectively and successfully. Okay.
Yes.
It doesn't mean at the other end that they never feel sad or miss someone, but it means they're emotionally complete. It means they can talk about them without being afraid that they will collapse, like what might be going on with your friend at the moment. To be able to have fond memories not turn painful, to be able to remember the person the way they knew them in life, not only as they knew them in death. Mm-hmm. And an awful lot of people get trapped at the ending because some of the endings are so difficult.
Sure.
Cancers, accidents, you know, suicides, all kinds of things. And so the other part of our goal for people is to have a life of meaning meaning and value, even though their life has changed by the loss. Okay, a lot of people don't know that's even vaguely possible.
Mm-hmm.
So in those six-word categories, different, better, more, hopes, dreams, and expectations, everything. And the key to the existence of our organization, the Grief Recovery Institute, and these books,
mm-hmm.
and what John James did to save his own life all those years ago, he sat down. He's a very methodical guy. And when he decided he was going to try to live, he had to say, what is different? And he sat down and said, what is different about the death of my baby from when my father died?
Mm-hmm.
10 years ago, or when my brother died. Now, when John was 25, his 21-year-old brother laid down to take a nap and died.
Oh, my.
It may have been the same condition that killed Jim Henson of the Muppets, that kind of pernicious pneumonia or something.
Yeah.
Something weird. You get it, you're in the hospital, you're dead. There's nothing they can do. And in asking himself that question, accidentally and brilliantly, he realized that the biggest difference, especially mm-hmm. between the death of his brother and the death of his baby, was all the hopes, dreams, and expectations he had. Uh-huh. He and his wife, they had a name for the baby, they had a room, and mm-hmm. and he, his son was going to have all the virtues. He was going to be a different father than his father was to him,
yes.
his alcoholic father,
yes.
and so on and so forth. And all the dreams died with the baby. And that was what unlocked mm-hmm. the door to recovery for John. He later, right at the same period of time, but later realized there had been some things happened while his wife was pregnant that affected what happened, because, or at least he thought so.
Yeah.
They were poor. They didn't have a lot of money then.
Mm-hmm.
And so the wife, in aid of being careful about money, didn't go get the kind of prenatal care she might have. Now, mm-hmm. that may or may not have been an element, but
sure.
John sure felt it was. So it made him, keyed him to the idea, the things I wish I had done or said differently, mm-hmm. better or more.
Mm-hmm.
And just, he began to construct. So the whole construction of grief recovery is based on truthful human emotional reality and gives us a search pattern, a map to go where to look. Now, even though each of us unique and our relationships with everybody are unique, mm-hmm. there's a little a template here.
Yes.
So that, I think I said, anyone who comes to grief recovery can get help if they're willing.
Right.
Because the format works for everyone regardless of the loss.
Yeah.
This applies to death of a child, death of a parent, death
right.
of an adult,
mm-hmm.
anyone, to divorce, to moving,
yes.
to job and career things,
mm-hmm.
to changes in body and health issues. There's an awful, I don't know if any of you have friends with MS and other things like
yes.
that, diabolical losses.
Mm-hmm.
And our the subtitle of the new version of the Grief Recovery Handbook is the Action Program for Moving Beyond Death, Divorce, and Other Losses, including loss of health, loss of career, and loss of faith.
Mm-hmm.
They're more intangible, but they're still very real.
Yeah.
And people need help with that.
So beautiful. And Russell, I think we could go on for a whole
hour,
2 hours, 4 hours.
Have we started yet?
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. We're actually down to our last couple minutes, and I want to make sure that the audience knows a little bit more about your other books, because you do have several. And again, we want to give the website out and how that all works. So please,
okay.
tell us the other books.
The first book, The Grief Recovery Handbook, which is a universal guide for all losses.
Okay.
Please get a copy. And look, let me tell you folks something. I don't care if you ever buy this book, because you can go to most libraries and get it.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to read it. If you have any interest, go to the bookstore, sit down on the floor, read the first 58 pages, which is part one.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can contact us if you want to see about going further. You can go to our website and find one of our grief recovery method specialists in your community. Okay?
That's great.
If you have children, regardless of age, all the way up to mid or late teens, the second book we wrote is called When Children Grieve,
mm-hmm.
and the subtitle is For Adults to Help Children Deal with Death, Divorce, Pet Loss, Moving, and Other Losses.
That's great.
Our co-writer on this is Dr. Leslie Landon Matthews, whose father was Michael Landon.
Oh,
okay.
Interesting.
Huh?
Yeah.
Leslie, she's a very, very dear pal. Our third book is called Moving On, and it carries a quote from Jane Seymour and her husband, James Keach, who are friends of ours. This is called, it's kind of a bad title and subtitle, Dump Your Relationship Baggage and Make Room for the Love of Your Life.
Mm-hmm.
And with the fellow authors at the table, you know, the problems you run into publishers with
yes,
titles.
Yes.
But this is a superb book.
Mm-hmm.
It is primarily focused on relationship endings, marriages, and non-marriages.
Mm-hmm.
And the fourth book just came out. It's called The Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss. I think ultimately will be our biggest book because it deals with the heartbreaking loss of unconditional love that's almost unexplainable. Our website, www.griefrecoverymethod.com.
You have been such an amazing guest. Thank you so much. Next week, we have a special guest who's going to teach us more about eating disorders and recovery. And Kelly's going to be trying to chime in remotely, as I had tried from Santa Fe.
I will absolutely do my best.
We will hope we're not in a Mercury in retrograde and technology will work for us. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Have an awesome week, and we will talk to you next week. But please download our shows anytime.
Yeah, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.